Hello and welcome to volume 135 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss three different ways to control vegetation, and we'll check to see what's happening in the oil and gas industry. This program is brought to you through the generous contribution of Forester Search, a service that makes it easier to connect landowners with consulting foresters. You can access the site through foresterssearch.com, or there's a link on this page, and you'll be given a roster of consulting foresters who can guide you through the next steps you'll face as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. For many, many years before the prevalence of the modern agricultural era, forest understories were kept open by the use of fire. Herbicide treatments of understories are now a tool, but where does that leave prescribed fire? John Stivers is who we thought of as we wanted to explore this topic. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Can prescribed fire still effectively manage vegetation?
Yes, sir. You know, when you think about it, it's been doing it for thousands of years, mainly by humans, indigenous people, as well as natural ignitions. But now we can do better because, you know, we can apply science that we understand and apply more of a targeted strategic approach to achieve the outcome that we're after. And the other way of thinking about it, you know, when you manage vegetation, you're kind of managing the wildlife as well. But if you don't know what you're doing, you can have, you know, unfavorable results. So, again, the secret is to apply the science, and you won't have any surprises.
Okay. In general, what's necessary to kill the tops of hardwood understory species? That's usually one of the goals.
Yes, sir. You know, most prescribed fires applied in what we call the dormant season, December through March, because atmospheric conditions better for smoke dispersal. But if your goal is getting an effective top kill of some of the woody understory, often this what we call warm season or growing season window is better, say April through even September. So that time of the year, this may sound contrary, but you actually want temperatures above 80 degrees, maybe 80 to 95 degrees. You want the normal humidity ranges, 35 to 50%. So kind of right down the line, a lot of these weather metrics, mainly to manage your smoke. But the key is you have to dial up the ambient air temperature and slow the fire down. You want that what we call residence time, more time of that heat against the stem to actually penetrate the bark and reach that lethal temperature to the cambium. Then you'll get a top kill. So that growing season window is really the best time. So folks that are trying to top kill and burn into December, you're not applying the science. You're not going to get the desired outcome.
Okay. How does a person learn more about how prescribed fire affects vegetation?
Well, there's a lot of things I'd recommend. These aren't in any particular order, but first of all, really suggest to a landowner, a practitioner, anybody, to attend a certified burn manager class. And that's a big commitment of time. It's 32 hours, but I promise you, you're going to come away with lots and lots of practical knowledge and tactics that will help you hit the target. So that burn manager workshop is a way. Another one is what we call learn and burn workshops, where they're actually live fire mentoring burning, where landowners can come and shadow experienced managers and practitioners and do a live burn all day, ask plenty of questions, observe. You're not going to learn everything in one burn, but it's just another way of getting more turns at the barrel. And in the meantime, you know, if people know any foresters or biologists or anybody that applies fire, just, you know, ask them, hey, is it okay if I come, you know, put my hands in my pocket and watch? Just get on as many burns as you can and ask questions, become a sponge. That's an experience that's a good learner. A couple of quick websites. One is it's called Fire Effects Information System, or FEIS. You could just Google FEIS. And that is a wonderful website. So take a look at that. Every September we have the annual meeting of the Alabama Prescribed Fire Council, a lot of presenters. So, again, that's always in September. You can look at the ALPFC.org website to register for that. That's coming up. And Another way is just visit the Alabama Forestry Commission website, you know, forestry.alabama.gov. That's a wonderful source, county foresters.
Okay.
So a lot of things at people's disposal.
All right. Well, very good. Thank you, John. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Well, John's talked about prescribed fire, but we also wanted to discuss the use of forestry herbicides to control unwanted plants, especially as a site preparation before planting. So we wanted to check in with Michelle Eisenberg. Hello, Michelle.
Hey, how are you?
If a landowner has cut his land last year, how does he start the site prep process using herbicides this year?
That's a good question, Hayes. And I'm right in the throes of it right now in June. So if a landowner cut last year and they want to plant back, loblolly, longleaf, slash, whatever it may be, even hardwood, they have got to get, if they had a consulting forester that worked with them, a timber buyer, forestry commission, they can handle it themselves. There's several different avenues that they can take to ultimately get to someone like me, a vendor that does the work. They have to decide ahead of time what species they are going to plant, and then does the site need fire? Because that's a huge tool in what we use with site prep. We had a large pine catch last year that I call where a lot of the volunteer pine have seeded back into these site prep areas that they're going to plant back. Then we have to look at how are we going to get rid of those volunteer pine. Are we going to utilize herbicides? Are we going to utilize fire? And the combination of the two. So, you know, there's some decisions the landowner needs to make. How do we get it back in production and then start the process? And like I said, I'm in the throes of that right now. I was drawing maps out this morning, very critical on imagery, locating imagery so we know what we're spraying. We're really technical compared to what we were 15 years ago and what pilots require actually up in their helicopter to spray our tracks.
Can you speak for a moment sure. about the timing of these applications, whether it's in green up or whether it's best to do it late in the year or during the middle part of the year?
Great question. I get that a lot of times. When people start to see green up on their site and you have ankle high, knee high hardwood sprouts coming out, they think it's time to spray. And what we look for are hip-high sprouts. You want to have adequate shoot-to-root ratio in order for the herbicide to be effective. So just because your site has greened up doesn't mean it's ready to spray. Each site has to be individually assessed and looked at for the height. And then basically what I do is I decide, is this an early site? Has this site laid out for a couple years? Did they just cut it last summer, this winter? And then it needs to be held till later in the year. So it's not one size fits all when we spray.
Okay. All right. Well, Michelle, thank you very much for that. Speaking of keeping an understory clear, another way is to use goats or small ruminants, as they're called in the biz. Dr. Uma Karki from Tuskegee University has studied how to do this. Welcome, Uma.
Thank you.
What are the basic facilities that are required to get started with woodland grazing with goats and these small ruminants?
Thank you, John, for this question. For the woodland grazing, we need to contain the animal in the facility, in the plots, wherever we would like to, we would like them to eat from. So obviously, very good perimeter fence is required to contain the animals in the system and also keep the predators out of the system, and then need the cross fencing for rotationally grazing those animals in the woodland. Another is the watering facility. The clean drinking water should be available 24/7, and the minerals designed for goats, or if we are using sheep, designed for sheep. Free choice 24/7 and shelters, although the tree shares will be providing some shade to the animal, but artificial shelters are necessary to protect them from rain and storm, that kind of stuff. And the guardian animals, trained dogs can be examples for guardian animals, because in woodlands, the predator attack can be a potential threat for the grazing animals.
What are some of the challenges to controlling understory vegetation in woodlands with animals like this?
Yeah, one of the challenges is the vegetation height. Animal will be just eating from a certain height, maybe around 5 feet. Or if they go, if the large animals who use mature animal may go up to 5.5 feet. Although some of the vegetation they pull down with the wicked stem or that kind of thing, they may pull down and eat some. But when we talk about just eating significant foliage, that would be certain height. And if the that unwanted vegetation is beyond that height, maybe we need to have another method of controlling that or in combination with another.
What can you do to solve that problem of only eating up to a certain height?
So if they are just only eating that, and if the woodland has the understory vegetation growing beyond that height, maybe that need to be cut one time and let the animal manage after that, year after year.
Mm-hmm.
That would be one of the solutions. So another challenge would be the initial cost involved with installing the fence.
Mm-hmm.
And supplement may be required because the woodland vegetation may not be providing all the nutrients needed for those animals. Predator, we have already discussed about that. That may be a challenge in woodland because of visibility and stuff like that. And the poisonous plant, if there are a lot of it in the system, sometimes animal may consume that in a significant amount and may be getting sick out of that. And another challenge is production duration. May to October, there will be lots of vegetation there for animals to eat, and another 6 month producer or landowner will have to have alternative feeding system for them.
Okay.
And one of the things that producer need to, or farm landowners need to have in mind, animals need regular inspection and care, unlike other control system that one time it is applied and people just go away for maybe a couple of years. It is not like that.
Right. Does require a lot of continuing effort. Well, thank you, Uma, for that. We appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
Well, it's not only what's on your land, but what's under it. Marvin Rogers is a former board member of the AFOA and general counsel for the State Oil and Gas Board. Hello, Marvin.
Hello, Hayes.
What's the current situation for oil and gas in Alabama?
Well, it's improved in just the last month. The economic climate for oil and gas exploration has improved enormously just in the last few weeks. In March and in February, with the combination of the virus pandemic and attempts by Saudis and Russia to control prices, the price of oil hit a new low. But now with people returning to more normal activity, demand has risen and the price has risen. Now, in the last, I'd say, 3 or 4 years, there has been very little new drilling in Alabama outside of Conecuh County. Conecuh County has been a star because you got two big fields down there at Brooklyn and one called Little Cedar Creek. So except for Conecuh County and then the counties where there's a lot of coalbed methane gas, and that's Tuscaloosa and Jefferson, there hadn't been much activity. But let's be hopeful that this price rise will cause some more activity. Probably that'll occur when the price gets to $50 or so a barrel. I've talked to a couple of independent operators about that. I know that a lot of forest owners in Alabama receive revenue from, like you say, under the ground in oil, gas, and coalbed operations. And so we're hopeful that there'll be more activity here in the next year as the price continues to rise, as economic activity increases as we get through this virus.
What kind of services does the Oil and Gas Board offer to landowners, and is there a fee for anything?
The main duty that the Oil and Gas Board has, Hayes, is to regulate oil and gas drilling and production. And to do that, the board conducts regular hearings. But for landowners, our offices offer a lot. We're in Tuscaloosa. We're on the campus of the University of Alabama. That's the headquarters of the Alabama Oil and Gas Board. and we have a publications office, and we have a library. Virtually everything is available at a nominal cost. I mean, you know, for just to make copies. For example, some of the things that we have that are useful are topographic maps. Everybody likes those, forest owners, landowners, everybody. Geologic maps. We have some publications on landowner rights and legal issues. We got an old library that goes back to really 1850, and so there are a lot of old documents that Dr. Smith had when he started Toomey and some of the early state geologists had. So we have a lot of documents here that people can look at, a lot of maps they can buy, a lot of information to be copied. Frankly, if somebody needs help collecting royalties, they can give me a call. If anybody wants to give me a call for any of this material, call me at the Alabama Oil and Gas Board. It's Marvin Rogers.
All right. Well, we thank you, Marvin. We've got your phone number on the webpage, so we appreciate that. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to John Stivers, Michelle Eisenberg, Uma Karki, and Marvin Rogers. The COVID pandemic is moving into a new phase now as businesses begin the process of reopening. It's interesting to note the role that paper played in the pandemic. A paper towel is what many people use to keep germs away when opening a door or using a gas pump. Paper shrouds the useless junk that you buy online, which is delivered to your front door. Masks are made from paper-like material and isolate our lives from the myriad germs and viruses that swirl around us, and so we actually depend on paper to keep us alive. And it's paper that's used to scribble a note that says, open for business, stand 6 feet apart, but come on in. So it's paper that'll get us back to work, back on track, and back in the swing of things. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.